All right, welcome back to Third String Podcast. Today we have an all-baseball episode lined up for you today. And instead of being joined by Pete and Ishan, I'm just being joined by Ishan today. So Ishan sitting there in the sweltering Chicago summer day. We can hear a little bit of the AC behind you, but welcome back to Third String. And how's your day going?
It's going well. And honestly, I'm not even really sure if it's hot. It just looks sunny and I'm nervous to turn the air conditioning off.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, I know all about how bad it can be without AC in Austin, so I do not blame you one bit. But before I hit the record button, you were talking about Bryce Love. I haven't seen this story yet, but I wanted to give you some space to talk about this. I know we're going to do mostly baseball, and Bryce Love is not a baseball player, although he probably could be awesome at it if he wanted to be. But tell me about this Bryce Love report.
This was just so annoying. This guy, Dennis Dodd, who's one of the CBS college football writers, wrote this article basically slamming Bryce Love for not going to Pac-12 media day because he had class. He had summer school. And as you may know, Bryce Love is a human biology major who wants to go to medical school after his football career is over. So this is like a, you know, presumably an important, difficult class. And he was like, I can't miss school. And so I'm just going to Skype in to do my interviews for Pac-12 media day, which was in Southern California, which seems totally reasonable for me. It's like a total fluff event. Like no one actually learns anything from Pac-12 media day, but he got slammed by Dennis Dodd. And I was super angry. Like this kid is doing everything that we should want college football players to do. Also, he's like an unpaid amateur athlete who has no obligation to go to a media day that makes him miss class.
Is anybody else slamming him, or is this a case of one reporter having a really bad take and then everyone piles on the reporter for criticizing an athlete unjustly?
It was definitely the latter.
Okay,
I did not see anyone agree with Dennis Dodd, so that was good. Dennis Dodd should feel bad about himself.
Okay, and yeah.
With that, we can move on.
All right, well, good for you, Bryce Love, for attending class. It reminds me of Andrew Luck, another of your favorite Stanford athletes, Ishan, taking school seriously. Imagine that.
I know. We could talk about this all day, but we should probably move on before I get too excited.
All right, yeah, sounds good. So, well, do you want to start with the topic that you first brought to my attention before we roll into more of the sort of standings-based discussion that we have lined up for today?
Yeah, so I don't know if you saw, there was this video going around on the internet of Josh Hader. So I guess maybe we should start at the beginning.
Yeah.
So Josh Hader, the Brewers superstar relief pitcher with an absurd strikeout rate and a whip of like 0.8. It's basically getting everybody out. I think left-handed batters are hitting 0.65 against him or something this season. But unfortunately, people dug up these old, incredibly offensive, very racist and homophobic and other things, tweets of his that included the N-word, KKK, white power, with a fist. It was bad. So Josh Hader apologized. Obviously, there have been some other players, Sean Newcomb and Trey Turner, with also bad, though somewhat less terrible tweets coming out. And then after the Hader apology, at his first game back at Miller Park, the Brewers crowd gave him a standing ovation, which I guess you could say, you know, obviously the reasonable thing to think is like they gave him a standing ovation for the apology, but it still was pretty weird to me because it seems like apologizing, you're trying to get back to neutral, not to like deserve to be applauded by an entire ballpark. So that was weird. And then Darnell Mayberry of The Athletic tweeted the day that happened, and to think I was this close. Darnell Mayberry covers the Bulls for The Athletic, and he's black, and he tweeted, to think I was this close to heading to Milwaukee yesterday to see Kershaw pitch. Good to know how some many Brewers fans feel about me and people who look like me, and please spare me the excuse about them just supporting their player. What's worse, realizing I would have had my four-year-old daughter with me and had to explain to her why Brewer fans were showering Hader with applause. Think about that. So this is just kind of an incident that boiled over recently, but I think there's a great New York Times article by Michael Powell. Who's Michael Powell? I should read his byline. Okay, I don't actually know who this is, but there's a great New York Times article looking at just race in baseball more broadly and noting that there's very few black players, very few American black players. And I think there's a stat in here that 83% of the viewing audience, according to survey evidence in baseball, is white. Did you see that in the article?
Yeah, I don't remember the exact number, but it is filled with statistics like that are showing baseball's overwhelming whiteness. And that's the title of the article is basically, with a standing ovation, baseball shows its whiteness.
So I guess the question is, I don't really know what the question is. It's just, is baseball?
Just put succinctly, is baseball too white? Does it have a problem with being too white?
Yeah, and I guess like more specifically than that, even, is there something baseball can do to not? Is it hostile in a way that we think is fixable to minorities, or is it just that like different people have different preferences and like baseball hasn't caught on as much in minority communities in America, but it's not really like a thing we think is, you know, bad in some tangible, fixable way.
Right.
What are your thoughts?
Yeah. So, I mean, as you can imagine, Ishan, I have a lot of thoughts. The first thing is, let me just issue a disclaimer that I am a white man. And so I don't pretend to be an authority on matters like this. I can offer my thoughts, but I certainly think that, you know, my perspective needs to be tempered by the perspectives of other people, you know, like yourself, Ishan, who is not a white man. So I think it's good that we're having this conversation, and I definitely want to hear your thoughts on this. I think briefly, the hater issue, certainly disappointing. It would be a bummer to, for example, own a hater jersey, because I wouldn't really want to wear a hater jersey after the news of his tweets broke. But at the same time, I think that people like Darnell Mayberry made a little bit too much of the ovation. He said, spare me the excuse of this being an example of a hometown fan base supporting its player. But I think we actually see that happen all the time, and we see it transcend racial barriers. So I'm thinking, for example, of Barry Bonds' support from the San Francisco Giants fan base, even after the all the allegations broke about his use of performance-enhancing drugs. And I'm not drawing an equivocation between using performance-enhancing drugs and being racist. But I'm just saying that I think we can't just write off this as being an example of a hometown supporting a player. I think that's what's going on. But let me caveat that by saying that I do think this is a great opportunity to sort of jump off and have a frank discussion about race and minority representation in baseball. And that's what I appreciated about the New York Times op-ed article that Powell wrote. Powell's a Sports of the Times columnist. He's written in the Times, I think, for like 4 years. I think he started in 2014. Very good writer. He is also a white man, but he has this great article, which I encourage everyone to read. I'm going to link to it from the show notes here. And he basically talks about this. You know, with this ovation, baseball shows its whiteness. And so there's the interpretation of the ovation that Darnell Mayberry brought up, that this is the Milwaukee fan base showing how it feels about black people. But there's another interpretation, which is this: them supporting their player. But even if that's the case, and Powell kind of brings these issues up, even if that's the case, they're still doing so without any regard for how it may be perceived. And when you look at the fan base that's applauding, they are overwhelmingly white. You know, there are.
I rewatched that video in slow mo, and I literally could not find a single not white person in the video.
Right,
like it's kind of hard to see because, you know, it's blurry. But yeah.
Yeah,
that's part of what made it a tough spectacle to withhold.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why it's really a bad look for Major League Baseball. And I do think that Powell might be onto something, that baseball is not good at making room for non-white players on rosters and non-white fans in the bleachers and non-white front office people and non-white managers. And I'm working on a piece. I've been working on it for a while, and I probably will be working on it for a while longer because I'm just trying to do it in my off time. But it's basically on sort of all the problems with baseball as we know it today. And number one on my list is the lack of minority and female representation in the sport. And I found this great Chris Rock monologue from HBO's Real Sports in 2015. He said, I'm just gonna quote from some of what Chris Rock said. That's from my piece. Last year, the San Francisco Giants won it all without any black guys on the team. So remember, this is 2015. So he's talking about the 2014 championship. And the team that the Giants had to beat, Chris Rock goes on, to get there had no black players either. None. Baseball isn't 20% black anymore, because it was at one time. It's 8% and falling fast. That's an average of 2 guys per team. So I went back and looked at the data. In 1995, 19% of players were African-American. By 2017, that number fell to 7.7%. And when you compare that to the NBA, which is 74.4% African-American, and the NFL, which is 69.7%, you see the huge disparity. So I think I have more to say on this, Ishan, but I'll turn it back to you. Real quick, that's an overview of my thoughts. I don't want to discard or trivialize the hater stuff, because it's serious, and Hader was right to apologize. But I'm really grateful in a maybe strange way. I'm grateful for the opportunity this gives us to have a good conversation about baseball's race problem, because I think it definitely exists. What about you?
So I think that, like, generally forgiving hater was reasonable. Like, these tweets were a long time ago. Although I would point out that I think 17-year-olds are...
Yeah, I mean, he wasn't a 12-year-old, right? There's a difference between, like, a 12-year-old saying that and a 17-year-old. Like, a 17-year-old's 1 year away from being able to vote. So, yeah, I totally agree with you.
Yeah, and I think there's definitely, I think, a little bit of a racial divide in how teenagers are viewed in terms of, like, should we treat them as adults? I think I tweeted something when the hater thing happened. It was a story of, like, a 17-year-old black kid who ran away from a traffic stop and got shot. And I was right. Like, you know, this kid was the same age as, like, these tweets haters being... So, I mean, I don't want to say he's being forgiven because he was a kid, but there's a lot of, like, oh, he was, like, a kid who didn't know any better. And I think that was generally the effect of his apology, is, like, I didn't mean any of this. I was just a kid, which I thought his apology somewhat was hollow and lacked depth, in the sense that he didn't really take responsibility for the feelings that he tweeted. He was just kind of like, I didn't really know what I was saying.
Right.
Which I would have liked to see a
little more real contrition.
A little bit more. It didn't feel like he actually was grappling with what he was saying or what had happened. It seemed like it was kind of more like, I'm sorry that this was offensive and that it got dug up. But I would have liked to see, like, a 5-game suspension or something for Hader.
Yeah, I mean, maybe something like Yoelisky Gurriel got for criticizing Yu Darvish in the playoffs last year.
Totally. Because even if it was a long time ago, like, the KKK is literally a terrorist organization, and this is, like, incredibly serious stuff. So, yeah, there's that. But I guess getting back to your thoughts, do you think there's anything – what can baseball do? So 5-game suspension for Hader, I mean, that would have been my recommendation, but obviously it would not, like, change the direction of the sport. Is part of it just that baseball is expensive for kids to play, and we have a wealth gap in America that coincides with race, and so it's easier for kids to go play basketball or football because you just need a ball and there's a lot of outdoor courts in most cities in America, because that seems like a thing that would be hard for Major League Baseball to do anything about? Or is it, I guess the question is, like, is there anything we think baseball should do differently, or is this just kind of an unfortunate fact that we don't really know how to fix?
Yeah, I think part of it does stem from the reality that baseball has a little bit more of an uphill climb to engage minority demographics in that way. Like you said, it's a lot easier to have a pickup game of basketball than it is to have a pickup game of baseball. And you spend any time in any urban area in the U.S., you're going to see way more basketball courts than you will see baseball fields. But at the same time, I don't know if that, you know, that singular fact, that sort of ease of access, accounts for it, because you don't see a ton of football fields either. And football requires a lot of specialized training the higher up you go. So I'm not sure if that explains all of it. I think a lot of it really has to do with MLB not making enough inroads. I mean, Little League is a great organization right now. The Little League playoffs are going on. But when you watch the Little League playoffs, I don't see many black players on Little League teams. I think there's a huge gap in which demographics are being reached by Major League Baseball through programs like Little League. And so that's the first thing that I would do if I were the commissioner and we're looking at this problem, is say we have to start young and we have to figure out how to get a diversify our rosters, even at the Little League level, which I'm not meaning to imply that MLB, like, controls Little League like that, but I think there's enough cross-pollination between the two. You know, MLB has their promotional game that they play in Williamsport every year in advance of the Little League World Series. Like, the MLB definitely recognizes that Little League is good for Major League Baseball and provides, in some case, the very beginnings of a talent pipeline. And I think that's where MLB needs to do a lot of work. And, you know, to their credit, they've done some of this outreach through the Boys and Girls Clubs of America, things like that. But I think they need to double down and triple down on these efforts, because the problem is just not getting better. Like I said, in 95, almost 20% of Major League Baseball players or Major League Baseball rosters were African-American. And now it's below 8%. It's just it's a night and day difference. And so something has gone wrong here. I think part of it's the ease of access thing. But I think that's only a part of the problem.
I'm going to toss in one more suggestion that's actually just a broader suggestion, but I think could potentially help with this problem a little bit, which is that The way MLB does their media copyright stuff is just ridiculous.
Yeah, I totally
for
agree.
The sport getting around. Like in the NBA, they actively encourage people to share their own highlights on YouTube and on Twitter. And in baseball, they basically shut it all down unless it comes straight from Major League Baseball. And I think that, you know, especially like the young black men that I hang out with and play basketball with, they consume a lot of their basketball through highlight videos rather than like sitting down and watching a whole game.
Right.
And I think baseball is even more of a highlight.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Like I saw, you know, that A's center fielder making that throw from the warning track straight to first base on the fly last night. Like stuff like that happens all the time, but very few people are like you and me where they're going to sit down and watch 3 hours of baseball on a regular basis.
Right.
So I think that would be helpful too. Just to make it kind of a more democratized sport to consume. And that would help with a lot of baseball's other problems. But yeah, I want to bring up – sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to add to that. There's this Twitter account, at Pitching Ninja. And if you go to his site, he has a ton of GIFs of pitchers pitching. I mean, that's literally all it is. And he has commentary on these pitches. But MLB got his account shut down earlier this year because they accused him of like retweeting or making GIFs of MLB advanced media content without – explicit written permission, and they ended up reaching some sort of an agreement, so his account was reinstated and all that. But it's a perfect example because this guy just through organic growth had I think upwards of 100,000 followers, and MLB got him shut down even though he was doing amazing things to promote and advance the sport.
So ridiculous. I don't know how anyone in the MLB thinks that they're pursuing a profit maximizing strategy.
Yeah, I really don't understand. And it's not like MLB is not forward thinking on media. I mean, MLB advanced media is just that. And in my opinion, you know, from an outside observer, MLB game day is a way better product than, you know, the NBA League Pass or NFL Game Pass. It's a really, really good product, especially if you've like played around on the iOS version of it at all. And MLB is going to great lengths to incorporate advanced analytics in their game in a way that's really, really engaging for people who are young people who are interested in computer science or programming. And I would think that all of those things could be really attractive for young people interested in the game to include minority communities, but it's just doesn't seem to be the case so far.
I want to bring up a related topic, which I know we want to actually talk about actual baseball, so you can cut this if we don't have time. But basically, Julia and I and another friend were discussing recently how we think baseball has been able to – like, what is our theory of which sports are getting caught up in all of the political polarization in America and which ones are managing to stay out of it?
Right.
In the sense that the NBA basically picked a side from day one. They were were relocating the All-Star game from North Carolina because of like transgender rights. And, you know, our players are going to wear I Can't Breathe t-shirts to protest police violence.
Yep. Greg Popovich stood very outspoken and one of the league's foremost coaches. LeBron James called the president a bum.
Yeah, absolutely. So the NBA picked a side, and football
is just a disaster. Yeah,
totally. And it seems like baseball, you know, there's been a little bit of Twitter stuff going on this past month or so, but for the most part, baseball's just totally been able to avoid having to pick a side. And I basically had two theories of that. I had one theory, and then my friend convinced me another theory is better. So my original theory was kind of like basketball is an urban sport. For the most part, it's like more popular in urban areas, and so they were able to pick a side pretty easily. Football is more popular in rural parts of America, I would venture a guess, and so they haven't really picked a side, but it's like picking a side is kind of important for them to, or it seems like they're getting caught up in it.
Right.
And my original theory, which I now don't like as much anymore, is that baseball is more of a suburban sport, and in suburban America, it's kind of the one place where, you know, people of different political views are still sort of managing to get along and live near each other. So maybe that's what baseball reflects. But then my friend convinced me that a better theory is that, football has like white fans and black players. Basketball has obviously wildly overgeneralizing,
right,
but there's some black players and many white fans. Basketball has many, many black players and many black fans, so it's easier for them to pick a side. And baseball just mostly has foreign minorities and very few American minorities who are primarily you know, driven by American-related political and social justice issues. And so they were mostly able to avoid picking a side because of the lack of black players. Do you find that to be like a compelling hypothesis, or do you have some alternative hypothesis, or how has baseball been able to stay out of this like big American fight?
Yeah, that's interesting. I definitely don't think it's your first hypothesis. No offense. I don't think it's the suburban one, because there are significant pockets of urban fan bases in places like, you know, the Northeast, where you haven't seen like a disproportionate amount of, you know, protesting compared to other baseball markets that are not in places like that.
Yeah, that's a good point. I don't like that hypothesis anymore either.
But the racial one is really interesting to me. I'm not sure if I would agree with it as a primary hypothesis, but I think it has to play a role. I would suggest maybe adding to that as a primary, or maybe a secondary if the first one's a primary. I would suggest that there's the degree to which a player is able to thrive as a singular superstar and the degree to which a player has a personal brand makes a big difference. You know, like everyone knows what LeBron is doing before a game. And, you know, as one of five starters, the cameras are in him a lot more than they are on Mike Trout, who, you know, and LeBron James is the transcendent basketball personality in the NBA in the same way that Mike Trout is the transcendent athlete in the MLB. But the way those things play out in front of a camera is totally different. Like nobody, I don't even know what Mike Trout's Twitter handle is. I don't even know if Mike Trout has one. Like he probably has one because his PR reps made him get one, but he's not active on social media, you know, and this is the guy who is baseball's superstar. You know, someone asked Bryce Harper recently if Mike Trout was the best player in the game. And Bryce Harper said, if you don't think that, you haven't been paying attention. Like there's no question that Mike Trout is the best player in baseball, but nobody knows who he is on social media. You know, he doesn't have a big following. Nobody looks to Mike Trout for their social cues. So people do that for LeBron, and people do that, to some degree, but I think to a lesser degree in football as well. So I think football has this problem managing the dynamics of like, are we a team sport? Are we all going to kneel, or are we going to, you know, allow our superstars to kneel and do that? You know, the teams that I think come out looking good are teams like the Philadelphia Eagles, who embrace their stars, like Jenkins, who choose to protest, and they openly support him, but not all the players do that. And the teams that come out looking poorly, like the Cowboys, are the ones who have, you know, general managers like Jerry Jones, who go after the singular players who choose to protest. And then MLB, I think just, it almost like doesn't even matter. I mean, I don't even know if you know this, Ishan. There was one player last year in the MLB who knelt. His name is Bruce Maxwell. He was a catcher for the Oakland A's. And like nobody cared.
I did know that.
Like it was a headline on ESPN for like a day or two, but ultimately like nobody cared. And nobody cared so much that by the beginning of this season, Bruce Maxwell was like, okay, I'm not going to kneel anymore. Like it was just not an effective form of protest because it just didn't garner a response. So I think that's the one thing I would say about the racial hypothesis is like, if the racial hypothesis was the primary one, I would think that an athlete kneeling in a, you know, primarily white sport with white fans, people would really get upset at, but that doesn't really seem to be the issue. I think like nobody really cared.
That's interesting.
But this does, I was actually going to mention the player branding thing, because I think this is another thing that MLB could do better. Like if you're trying to get your product in front of more people and trying to engage a more diverse audience, then you need to be better at marketing your players. And totally. I think MLB knows they have a problem with this. In fact, Rob Manfred, the commissioner of MLB, got in trouble with the Angels organization around the All-Star break because he did an interview and he basically said, we want to market our guys like Mike Trout, but if we're going to market Mike Trout, we need to have support from Mike Trout to do that. And the Angels were like, whoa, don't come after our guy. You know, Mike Trout's never done anything to you. Don't call him out like that. But I think there is a
part of the problem here too. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, go for it.
Good. But I think part of the problem here too is just that baseball, probably way more than basketball, and probably more than any other sport, is team success is uncorrelated with best player success. So, yes. Like in the NBA, there's five guys on the court,
right.
And you're a top five player in the league, you're at least going to be a playoff team. But
whereas baseball, you can be Mike Trout and you'll never make the playoffs.
Yeah, I mean, I like it infuriates me how people who are baseball fans, people I know who watch their hometown team regularly, literally have never heard of Mike Trout.
Right.
And I think Mike Trout is potentially like not just the best baseball, I think he's potentially the best athlete that's played in this century in like the major American sports. Like, I personally think that Mike Trout might be better than like LeBron and whoever you think the best football player is, whatever. I mean, that's like a longer conversation, but he's like that level.
Yeah, super hard to compare across sports, but yeah, your point stands. I mean, he's that level.
Yeah, and like whether or not you think he's actually as good as LeBron or not, the point is that he's like in that range, and literally everyone in America knows who LeBron is, and like 5% of Americans could pick Mike Trout out of a lineup.
Right. Yeah, totally agree.
So should we talk about the actual games?
Yeah, sure. I think we'll just, you know, we're not going to solve this problem in one podcast, so we'll just sort of end our thoughts there. I do invite thoughts from listeners, so if you have additional things you want to chime into this conversation, please do that. Twitter, at Third String Pod, or at Zach Crippen, or at Shoulda Kept JB is Ishan's handle. So we'd welcome your feedback and let us know what we're missing here. So with that, Ishan, let's move on. I want to talk about some MLB storylines today. The Red Sox are the team that have been catching my eye and the eye, I think, of most baseball fans lately, because coming into the season, I did not expect the Red Sox to be doing what they're doing now. They signed JD Martinez, which I thought was, you know, a good signing, but a rather uninspiring signing. And now, three quarters of the way through the season, it's looking more like an absolutely inspired signing, because what JD Martinez has been able to do on the Red Sox has been incredible. And you pair that with the performance of Mookie Betts and Andrew Benintendi, and you have a team that is on pace for 113 wins this year, which would be the best ever for a Boston Red Sox team. So is this Boston Red Sox team the best in history?
I mean, I guess it depends how you weight regular season versus playoff success, because the playoffs are still kind of series of coin flips.
So will they get eliminated in the divisional round? I guess we'll have a different discussion then.
I mean, we were talking about the Indians won 22 in a row last year and around this time, and they won 103 games, and then they lost in the first round. So I think how we remember this Red Sox team will be heavily influenced by that. I don't know. I don't know Red Sox history that well. I don't think I have anything deep to say about this. What do you think?
So I've got a couple things. Right now they have a 7.06 winning percentage. That is slightly overperforming their Pythagorean win-loss. And the Pythagorean win-loss for our non-baseball sabermetrics fans, is basically a prediction of your win-loss record based on the simple formula of involving runs allowed and runs scored. So their Pythagorean is 670, which is a little bit less than what they are actually on pace to do right now, but not by much. So 670 is their current Pythagorean win-loss. That is right now the highest ever for a Red Sox team, just ahead of the Pythagorean win-loss of 669 for the 1912 Boston Red Sox. So you have to go back more than a century to find the team that's done this. That team, the 1912 Boston Red Sox, did go on to win the World Series, but they had a win-loss record of 691, winning 105 games. So that was a 154-game schedule, not the 162 that we have today, but still that was a lower win-loss percentage than what the current 2018 Red Sox are on pace for. So how about that for a bit of baseball gee whiz trivia, Ishan?
That is some pretty deep digging you did there.
I mean, I've just been really fascinated because the Red Sox seem totally unstoppable. And I think what really got me thinking about that was the sweep of the Yankees this past weekend. Bill Simmons was calling it the Boston Massacre because the Yankees went up for a four-game series in Boston. They were, I think, behind the Red Sox by 5 or 5.5 games going in. So with a sweep, obviously they had a chance to almost move up to even with the Red Sox, but instead they got swept, and then the Red Sox had a 10-game lead by the time it was all said and done. At the time, the largest division lead, even larger than the Indians' lead in the AL Central. So this team is for real. I'm really excited to see what they do come the postseason, which they've almost clinched at this point. It's ridiculous.
So, I mean, one thing I'd like to point out also is just it's still early to be making these historical kind of proclamations.
That's fair.
So the Red Sox are 84-35, and that's very good. But also, let's note that last year's Dodgers were 91-36. So the Red Sox would have to win 7 of their next 8 to get to where the Dodgers were on August 25th last year. And then, of course, the Dodgers lost 15 out of 16 or something like that or more. 16 out of 17. I just counted.
Yeah, I remember that. That was quite a collapse.
And then, you know, they made it to Game 7 of the World Series and lost. So, like, we don't know what this is going to look like the rest of the season. And the Red Sox are a great team, but they're not a team without any holes.
Right.
And so we'll see. I think I would be comfortable with proclamations like this is one of the best teams ever on August 10th, August 12th, or whatever. But there's still a lot of baseball left.
Yes, there definitely is. Do you think that the Red Sox, if you were to choose a World Series victor right now, if you were to, you know, put $5 down on who win the World Series, would you bet on the Red Sox?
No, I think I would take the Astros.
Okay, fair enough. Well, speaking of the Astros, that's the one AL race, surprisingly, perhaps, that's the one AL race that's actually looking like it's still a little bit of a race. You have the Oakland Athletics, who have now finally surpassed the Mariners. The Mariners were, for a long time there, the beneficiaries of some really good luck and were overperforming their win expectancy. So now you have the Oakland Athletics creeping up on the Astros, and the Astros have really kind of been underperforming, especially relative to what people thought they were going to do coming into the season. So do you think the Athletics will eventually catch the Astros?
No, I don't. The Astros have almost the same run differential as the Red Sox. The Red Sox are plus 210. The Astros are plus 196. There, you were talking about the Pythagorean wins and losses.
Yep.
I also love that stat. The Astros are league MLB worst minus 7 actual wins versus real wins. So they basically should be 7 games better than they are based on their run differential. I think they win the division. I guess I could see some of their slightly older pitchers wearing down a little towards the end of the season. Maybe that would be a little bit of a concern. And then, you know, the bullpen's always a bit of a concern in Houston. And now, of course, we have all this controversy in the Houston bullpen with the recent trade. But no, I think the Astros win that division, and I don't think it's that close in the end. What do you think?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think the Astros will start to pull away here. The run differential is substantially more than that of the Athletics, which is 64. I don't know if you mentioned the Athletics run differential yet. But yeah, I think the Astros significantly a better team. The Athletics are only, is it 2.5 games behind right now?
3.5.
3.5. But that's just a lot of ground to make up given the performance we've seen so far. The Astros are scoring more runs per game, and they're allowing almost one run less per game, which doesn't sound like a whole lot until you average it over the course of a season, and then it's an awful lot. I don't think they'll catch him. What do you think about this possibility, though? Is there any chance you think that the Yankees actually slip below the Mariners, and the Mariners and Athletics sneak into the playoffs, and the Yankees get shut out in the cold?
So right now, the Yankees are 6 games ahead of the Mariners for the second wildcard spot, and the Mariners have a run differential of minus 23, which is actually like 51 runs worse than the Angels, despite having a 9-game lead on the Angels. I mean, I don't know. The Mariners have defied gravity all season long. It's absurd. It seems like eventually gravity will catch up to the Mariners. I think it's too much. I think the Yankees are definitely in the wild card game.
So per FanGraphs, the Yankees have a 99.9% chance of making the playoffs. Do you think that's overstating it a little bit? I would probably put it in the like mid 90s, maybe even high 90s. But 99.9 suggests to me there's only 1 in 1,000 chances that the Yankees don't make it, and that seems like it's a little bit remote.
I mean, so the 538 projections are generally more conservative than FanGraphs, I think, because they take they have just more variance in their assessment of team performance or team like actual true team quality. And they also have the Yankees at greater than 99%, which only the Indians and Red Sox have achieved. So I guess FanGraphs is consistent with like the industry standard for these projections.
All right, fair enough.
I think part of it is just because all of these projection systems think the Mariners are actually not good.
Yeah. I mean, I think that is certainly true. And like I said, they were just the beneficiaries of some really good luck early on.
Yeah, totally.
Well, let's pivot to the NL, which I think is a much more interesting league right now. So let's go NL East first. We have the Nationals, who are 5.5 games off the lead. The Phillies just retook the lead from the Braves last night in a late night win over the Brewers. So the Phillies now are 1 game ahead of the Braves in the NL East. Do you think they hold on? They have a worse run differential than the Braves. So the Braves should theoretically have a better record than them. And I've said for a while, I think the Phillies won't be able to hold on, but I'm sort of questioning myself as we go further along and the Phillies are holding on by just a little bit, but I still have to think the Braves will catch them by the end. What do you think?
I have said this all season and I'm continuing to stick with my hot take that the Nats are going to come back and win the division.
That's what I was saying at the All-Star break as well. And it's just really not looking probable. They really can't get one or two games above 500. I mean, it's theoretically they're three games above 500 now, but they can't get much above 500.
They're 5.5 games back right now. 538 has their win the division probability at 12%. So right. This is definitely a hot take.
Fangraphs has 23.9. So a little bit more on your side there.
Fangraphs, I find, relative to the other projection systems, seems to really weight preseason projections based on player quality very heavily rather, and doesn't update as much during the season.
Well, that's what everyone was saying about the Nats. Like, they have one of the most talented rosters in baseball, but we've just not seen the results.
Yeah, no, and I still think that's true. And I think a really important thing to remember here is that Steven Strasburg threw 64 pitches in the bullpen yesterday, or today. Today's Sunday? Yeah, yesterday. And is expected back in 2 weeks. And I just think that the Strasburg-Scherzer combination combined with a finally heating up Bryce Harper, and there's just offensive talent all over that field. And you combine that with two ace starting pitchers, once they get Strasburg back for the stretch run, I don't think 5.5 games is insurmountable. And, the other teams are so young. Anything could happen. I definitely think it helps a lot that the Phillies have added Jake Arrieta. It's like one more guy who is used to this stretch run kind of thing. And the way Nola's pitching, I think they have two really good pitchers too. And obviously, Foltynewicz is, am I saying his name right? I don't really know how to say his name.
I'm not really sure. I think it's Foltynewicz.
Anyways, the guy who throws 100 miles an hour on the Braves, and Sean Newcomb, who almost threw a no-hitter against the Giants a few weeks ago, along with Tehran. I mean, they all have good starting pitching, so maybe I'm unfairly weighting the top two guys in the Nats rotation, especially the way Gio Gonzalez seems to be falling apart recently. But I don't know. I still think the Nats win the division. Okay. I think it'll be extremely close, and I could see all three of them coming down the stretch with a chance to win in the final week of the season.
Well, and that's how the whole National League looks right now. So you have the Phillies at 560, the Cubs at 578, the Dodgers at 542. Those are the division leaders, respectively, although the Dodgers are tied with the Diamondbacks right now at 542. And the Phillies have the Braves just one game behind them, the Nats 5.5 games behind them. The Cubs are 5.5 games ahead of the Cardinals, but only two games ahead of the Brewers. And as I already mentioned, the Dodgers are tied with the Diamondbacks, and the Rockies are only a game and a half back. So, I mean, if any of these teams has a, 2017 Dodgers-type surge, or if any of the teams go on a, circa 2007 Rockies-type surge, and they just go and, win 15 of 16, I mean, the division is theirs to lose. And that's what's so exciting about the NL right now, is that we could see literally anything happen. The Nationals could surge ahead and win their division. Theoretically, the Cardinals could do the same. The Rockies could do the same in their division. And then any of the current division leaders could get left out in the cold and completely out of the playoffs. I think of those, the Cubs, I would say, have the highest chance of making the playoffs, and I think they almost certainly will. But I think it's not necessarily a given that the Cubs will win the division. And if the Brewers go on a tear, they could rest control from the Cubs. And I also think the Dodgers, surprisingly, although you sort of mentioned this in our preseason discussion, Ishan, you call the Dodgers as the underperforming team of the year. The Dodgers could also lose out on a playoff berth. I don't think they will with the addition of Machado and now Dozier, but it's theoretically possible. If the Dodgers go on a losing slump, and they find themselves at a 530 winning percentage and a few games back from the Diamondbacks by the end of the season, that 530 is probably not going to be enough for them to win the division. Even so, if the Diamondbacks were even just a half game ahead of the Dodgers right now, the Dodgers would be missing out on a playoff spot because their winning percentage is lower than that of the Braves and the Brewers, who are second place in their respective divisions.
Yeah, I mean, it's just absolutely crazy and a ton of fun. This really reminds me of the Western Conference playoff race last year, the National League, in the sense that, in the West, after the Rockets and Warriors, you had 3 through basically 11 or 12. Any of them had a chance to finish third, and any of them had a chance to miss the playoffs as late as 2 weeks left in the season.
Yeah.
And this is kind of that minus the Rockets and Warriors, where the Cubs have the best record right now in the National League, and the eighth best team, which is a tie, 7 and 8, is a tie between the Cardinals and Rockies, are only 5.5 behind the Cubs. So you have 8 teams within 5.5 games of either finishing the season with home field advantage right. in the first throughout the NL or missing the playoffs. And that doesn't even include the Nats, who are a couple games further out of that, and we both think are still contenders and, you know, the third or fourth best run differential
right.
in the NL. So yeah, I picked the Diamondbacks to win the West at the beginning of the season. And given that that was kind of a risky pick and they're tied for the division lead on August 12th, I might as well stick with it. But I really, this Kenley Jansen injury, we're already seeing hurt the Dodgers, you know, yesterday. 2 outs and a man on second in the 9th inning with a 2-run lead, 2-0 against the Rockies, and a hit batter and a 3-run homer later, and they lose 3-2 without their closer. And we don't know when Jansen's going to be back with this unfortunate irregular heartbeat that's right. recurred for him. And I just, this has been true since the beginning. I just don't trust the Dodgers pitching staff behind Kershaw and Jansen. I think Alex Wood is a solid pitcher, but I think he's not a good second best starting pitcher on a division winner kind of pitcher. And the rest of these guys, you know, Hill, Maeda, they're like decent, but I wouldn't say that I guess Stripling's been really good this year. I sort of yeah. forgot about Stripling. And then the bullpen just lacks depth with Jansen out. Meanwhile, Greinke and Corbin have been a really good 1-2 punch for the Diamondbacks. And while they've had their bullpen problems too, honestly, I sort of trust the top couple guys in the Diamondbacks. Is this true? Do you think Peralta, Pollock, and Goldschmidt, who I think are the three best offensive players on the Diamondbacks, are better three best players than the Dodgers' three best players? I mean, we don't need to go too deep into sure, yeah. That was just kind of a question off the top of my head. But I do think that the last few years by the Dodgers, it's kind of a weird thing because they do spend a lot of money and have a lot of big money players. But they've been unusually reliant for a perennial contender on, like, new guys stepping up out of nowhere every year. So, like, Justin Turner was not a star player a couple years ago and sort of overnight morphed into a star. And then a similar thing has happened with, like, Chris Taylor, Max Muncy, guys who were, like, mid-career guys who had always been right. kind of okay players suddenly turn into stars. And that's always made me a little suspicious of the Dodgers. And so right now, coming down the stretch, I still feel like every given day the Dodgers have a different lineup that's like optimized for the opposing pitcher. And that can be a good thing, but it's also like, it's hard for me to think of after Machado and maybe Bellinger, like who would I really count on to have a good stretch run for the Dodgers?
Right.
And so maybe I just trust the Diamondbacks a little more because I know they have a couple guys who I like really trust.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. That's fair.
But I do think the Rockies are going to fall out of the race. I think that the way their offseason signings of Wade Davis and Brian Shaw have imploded is just going to ultimately, with Coors Field, it's just going to be too much for the bullpen to bear. Yeah, the few guys who are still getting outs are going to get exhausted.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. So the offseason acquisitions have not gone well. The other thing is they locked Charlie Blackmon into a much longer, more expensive contract, and he has just not been the same player that he was prior to that signing. And then I think a lot of people thought that they would make some moves before the trade deadline to try to make up some of this ground, and they just didn't. It was a very quiet trade deadline for the Rockies. They didn't make any big splashy trades, and I think because of that, yeah, they'll just find themselves sort of slipping into irrelevance as the season winds down.
One thing that's interesting, you know, talking about how all these Dodgers players, I find it fascinating how they move all their guys around the field so that they can optimize the batting order to get, you know, the best matchups for that day's pitcher. Yeah. So Bellinger's playing center field now. You know, Austin Barnes plays catcher and second base. Chris Taylor, shortstop, center field. I think he's probably played corner outfield a few times too. I think it's really a fascinating trend in baseball how I'm not sure if this, I'm just saying this because I'm a Chicago guy, but I'm not sure if it was the 2016-2015 Cubs that started this trend, but certainly the Cubs do that a lot. You know, Chris Bryant, Javi Baez, all their guys, Ben Zobrist, moving all around the field. Ian Happ. And now we're seeing the Dodgers do it. And then the Brewers, with their trade deadline moves, adding Mike Moustakas and Jonathan, how do you say his last name? Scope?
Yep, Scope.
Scope. With they're, you know, Moustakas is primarily a third baseman, and they already had Travis Shaw and I think Eric Thames plays there too, and Braun plays there sometimes. And then Scope is like a second baseman, but he's playing some shortstop now. And Travis Shaw's just moving all over the field, infield, outfield. He'd never played an inning of professional baseball at second base, and he's starting there semi-regularly now. So I think it's just a really interesting trend how baseball guys are like, oh, if you can play defense, you can play defense.
Right, a little more flexible around the diamond, yeah.
I don't know if you have any thoughts on, I don't know if it's too early or whether we have a good way to judge how that experiment's working out. I think it's certainly working out well for the Cubs and Dodgers. I don't know about the Brewers, given how reliant they've been on their defense to carry them all year, whether it's going to be more of a problem for them. But I don't know if you have any thoughts on this.
I don't have any well-formed thoughts, and I haven't seen any really good data sort of judging whether or not this has been a net positive or negative for teams either. But I am encouraged by the shift because, no pun intended there, I am encouraged by that because it just makes it a little bit more exciting when you can see some variety and see Javi Baez play second, but then also with third and potentially even some corner outfield action. I mean, it's just a little bit more fun when you get to see things be a little bit different from day to day on the diamond.
Yeah, and I could see it being successful. I mean, for the Brewers in particular, putting Orlando Arcia in the lineup every day at shortstop, I think he's definitely not one of their eight best offensive players.
Right.
And then between, you know, Yelich and Kane are out there every day, and then between Thames, Shaw, I'm blanking on some of the other, Moustakas and Braun and Aguilar, you're basically going to have to sit two of those guys every day unless you make Shaw play second base.
Right.
And then you can only sit one of those guys. And then to get Scope in the lineup too, you can put him at shortstop, which is not his natural position, but he can sort of get by there. So I think it makes a lot of sense for the Brewers just to have their eight best players on. It's kind of like the NBA. It's like positionless sports, not just positionless basketball.
Right.
Like, we just want our best dudes on the field, and we think that's going to be better.
And this is a separate discussion, but on the positionless point, that's what's happening a lot of times with a shift. You just have these guys totally not conforming to the traditional positions on a baseball field. They're just playing where it makes the most sense to play defensively in any given moment.
That too. I was not even making that connection, but that totally is part of it.
And so, you know, theoretically, you could have guys mid-inning just switch. You could have the person who was playing shortstop move over and play left field or whatever. And we haven't seen that happen, but you know, we're sort of moving in that direction.
So should we sum this up with like final predictions for three division winners and two wildcard winners in the National League?
Yeah, what do you have?
Today, August 12th.
Yep.
I am going to go with roughly, this might've been the exact same predictions I had at the beginning of the year, except for one wildcard team, but I'm going to go Nats, Cubs, Diamondbacks in the divisions, and which teams do I think are going to win the wild card? Ooh, I'm going to be super boring and just say the Brewers and Dodgers win the wild card and that the young Phillies and young Braves don't quite have enough down the stretch.
Okay, man, no love for the National League East. I like your picks. It's all going to be close. I think that the Nats are not showing enough gas to make up the 5.5 game deficit in the NL East. I think the Braves, however, will pass the Phillies. So I think you'll have the Braves winning the NL East. They'll be playoff bound. I think you'll have the Cubs locking up their division and home series advantage in the playoffs. And I think the Dodgers will be able to fend off the Diamondbacks. I think the Diamondbacks have been hit by the injury bug too much. They have a lower run differential. I think over the final stretch, we'll just see them fade a little bit. And I think you'll see the Brewers get one of the wild cards, and I'm going to go with the Phillies getting... No, I'm going to go with the Braves getting the other wild card. So Braves and Brewers are your wild card. Braves...
Wait, I thought you
sorry,
had the
I,
Braves
I did.
In the
right.
division.
Phillies are getting the wild card, yeah. So Braves win the NL East, Phillies get a wild card, Cubs win the Central, Brewers get a wild card, Dodgers win the West, Diamondbacks get left out in the cold.
I'm going to make another prediction that semi-contradicts my first prediction.
Okay.
I think we're going to see two extra one-game playoffs this year. I think that the second wild card and one division will end in a tie.
Oh, wow. Nice. I like it. And then we have one of the one-game playoffs.
Oh, and that would be so great as a, you know, as a Cubs partisan, that would be so great if you finish with the best record and then you face some team coming off burning all of their pitchers in three one-game playoffs on Monday, Tuesday,
That's
Wednesday.
True. That's exactly, yeah. That would play very well in the Cubs' favor.
And that's what I'm rooting for.
Right. All right. Fair enough. Anything else for baseball before we wrap it up here, Eshan?
I just want to point out that it's really great how in this podcast I managed to hate on the Brewers and give some love to Stanford football, and you managed to hate on the Cowboys, give some love to the Eagles, and also give some love to the Phillies.
That's a good point, actually.
We're staying in character with our third string bench warmer sports fan podcasters.
Absolutely.
We're just here to give opinions, but also we're primarily driven by our love of our hometown teams.
That's true. Yeah, I can't argue with that. Well, if you also want to give your opinion as a listener to this podcast, please do at Third String Pod, at Zach Crippen, or at Shoulda Kept JB, reference to Jimmy Butler. Longtime listeners know that reference. But anyway, Eshan, thanks so much for hopping on with me today. I'll talk to you next time.